Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Dana Perlin on the show. Dana is the owner of the South of Shaw Beer Company in downtown Fresno, California on Broadway Street. Not only do they have great beer, but they also have some of my favorite pizza in town. And I was so excited to talk to Dana. South of Shaw is one of the places that I love to hang out at. If you're there on a Friday night, there's a high probability you'll see me. It's become kind of an institution of downtown, and I wanted to understand the culture and the concept behind it. And I asked Dana to come on to talk about its history, talk about his understandings of beer making, talk about the complicated world of pizza, and a lot more. Let's go meet Dana, and Baker will take us there. One small note before we get started with today. We did record this inside the tap room, and so the last 5 to 10 minutes, you'll start to hear more and more chaos as people start to file in to order pizza and beer in the evening. I kind of like it. It really makes you feel like you're there. Enjoy.
Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best. Fresno's best.
Perfect. So, Dana, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Yeah, we don't go really out to eat much, to be honest with you. So when I do go out, I like to go someplace nice. And so we go to Parma. When we do go out, we go to Parma. We spend some money. And
A restaurant that's been recommended multiple times, one that I still have not been to. Yeah. What do you like about it?
It's fantastic. It's just really good Italian food. I love Italian food. Yeah. That's why we make pizza. And they just make a lasagna that's unbelievable. And,
okay. What makes it so great?
When you make lasagna, you have to do it with bechamel. Like a lot of people will substitute that, but there's no substitute for bechamel. And they do it really good.
It's like a good technique there to produce that.
Exactly.
Good.
It makes it really rich.
And then what is bechamel for people that don't know what that is?
It's essentially butter and flour. It's butter, really.
It's like an Italian gravy kind of thing.
Yeah, you make butter and flour, and then you put it in the lasagna, and it just gives it that super richness that clogs your arteries and all that good stuff.
Yes. Italian food is great for that reason. So I'm going to ask you a lot of questions today about your background, but also just beer culture questions.
Yeah.
In your experience, how long does it take a home brewer to reach a level where they're producing something consistent enough to sell? I know you started as a hobbyist, a brewer in your garage.
Yeah.
What's that actual learning curve in terms of time duration?
The interesting thing, the fun thing about making beer as a hobbyist is you can make drinkable beer like right away. You know what I mean? If you're just not sloppy, you can make drinkable beer right away. But I would say it took me a couple of years before I was making beer that was...
What were the signs for you that you'd hit that point?
It says you just get feedback from people because everybody will drink free beer. You know what I mean?
It's
so
true.
People are going to come over and drink your home brew and they're going to love it. But it's later when people start telling you, hey, this is really good. This is better than I had it or something like that. Then you start really, hey, this is special. And at first it just feels good and that's all you really care about. You're just making beer for your friends. Just like cooking for friends. You just want them to be happy.
And that kind of like inflection point between a hobby and a job, it can be vague for some people.
Yeah.
Because you'll make something that's really good, but that doesn't necessarily mean you should do it as a career. Right. And so how did you think about that? What was your kind of thought process?
That's the funny thing about any kind of hobby. I'm a musician too. And it's like, as soon as you start doing your hobby for money, it sucks the life out of it a lot of times and it becomes not fun. And so you really have to think about that, right? Do you really want to do that with this thing or do you want to continue to have a good time with it?
Let me ask you about music. What do you think's the most transferable skill from your music world to your beer world?
I don't know. I'm an analytical person, and I think that helps me on both sides. You know what I mean? You can analyze a part and what goes in a part, a musical part. Beer's the same way. You got to break it apart and analyze it. And I think any problem you're trying to solve, it's if you have good analytical skills, it works.
Yeah. If you were to start this all over again now, is there anything you'd do differently?
No. No, really wouldn't. In fact, we're looking to do another one, and we'll probably do it almost the same. Okay. Not exactly the same, but we'll do it. Pretty much the same. But I think just doing what we do, we wanted to be the neighborhood pub from the beginning. Yeah. That's what we wanted, a place where people could come and hang out. So it wasn't, for me, it wasn't about, oh, come and get the greatest new beer. It was about, hey, come and hang out, meet your neighbors.
I'm going to affirm you in that. This place has a vibe to it that not a lot of breweries in town or restaurants in town have, where there's like a hospitality and casualness in the space. Mm-hmm. How do you think you create that? We're going to talk about beer business later, but like, how do you think you create that?
I'd have to ask my wife that, honestly. What happened with me is I went to England for work when I was younger. And that's what actually got me into homebrewing too. But I fell in love with their pubs because they were just these warm, cushy places with a lot of woodwork and books. And, and everybody was just super cool. Everybody
Those
wants
places
to meet
everybody are else. Quiet though.
Yeah, they exactly. Yeah. They can be. And then until they have soccer on the TV.
Yeah, that's true.
But so when we started this place, I told my wife, I want an English pub, but I don't want, it still has to be a California brewery,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But I definitely want that feel because I want people to come in and relax together. So we made conscious decisions not to do TVs and things like that because we want people to talk, you know?
Yeah. I did notice that initially when I first came in here, no TVs, and that's an interesting choice where you're serving alcohol because those things are often correlated.
Sure. Yeah.
Do you think that's hurt you at all?
No, not at all. In fact, we get told all the time, thank God you guys don't have TVs.
Because it tends to attract a certain kind of crowd.
Yeah. But what do you do? Enough. Most of the time you're just... most of the time there's nothing on unless there's a game, but most of the time it's just noise. It's background noise, and we don't need more background noise in our lives.
No. So. As a society, we need to talk more.
Yeah.
All right. So I've got a bunch of beer questions. Yeah. I'm very excited for the pizza questions. We're going to save those for a little bit. Do you think people want to try new things when they drink beer, or do you think the average person looks for some consistent beer and wants to order that repeatedly?
Yeah. So I know what my sales look like, and I would say most people like something that they can rely on.
Okay.
So our best sellers are Mexican Cerveza. And I don't know if you compare it to anything, it has to probably be somewhat like a Corona, right?
Yeah.
And but that we sell so much of it that I can't keep up. So that tells me that people just like that. And it's our lightest beer, too.
Because a lot of breweries, they'll try new things,
sure.
explore things. And it seems like it's finding a balance between experimentation and consistency.
Right.
Like, how do you think about that kind of ratio? In your
head? See, I'm a traditional brewer anyway. I like traditional styles. So my personality is not one that lends itself to crazy new things. I don't like putting weird ingredients in beer and seeing what happens. It's just not my thing. I would much rather make a 200-year-old style English ale than put cookies in my beer or something.
Absolutely.
So, but that's a personal style thing.
How are you able to be consistent when you hit scale with beer? Is it similar to baking in that you're just like adding an exponent to quantities, or are there other things as you start to get bigger that you have to account for in terms of delivering that consistency?
Yeah, it's really just about process. If your process is controlled and it's the same every time, you're going to make the same beer every time.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about this before we went on, is that inherently with craft beer versus big commercial breweries, we don't have the level of control that a giant beer company does. Like, they've got scientists on staff and they're just controlling every last thing.
It's almost like big agriculture.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But so making beer on a craft level is like you mentioned bread making. It's like making craft bread. Each batch is going to be a tiny bit different.
Yeah.
But that's, to me, that's the fun of it.
Do you think people's palates notice those small nuances? I've asked each of the brewers that I've talked to so far, do you think people can notice that?
Some people can. I don't think most people can, honestly. Most people, honestly, the regular beer drinker, again, he's here to hang out. He's here on a date. He's whatever.
Yeah.
And so he's just, hey, give me that light beer over there because it goes with my food.
Yeah, the vehicle in some ways.
So we do get some people who are just really, hey, I want this beer in this glass because I don't like how it tastes in that glass. They're like, I want the shape of this glass better. Just weird stuff like that. But and we accommodate, of course, but that's not the norm.
Okay. Can a beer's flavor change with the kind of glass you pour it in?
It's the aroma that changes. And it's just if you have a round glass or that collects the aroma, like a Belgian glass versus a straight pint glass.
Yeah. So what kind of beers do you choose a stemmed glass for?
So here's the thing. Here's how I do it.
Yeah.
We don't really do it based on flavor. I do it based on nationality. So if I'm serving English beers, I'll use English glasses. If I'm serving German beers, I'll use a German Pilsner glass. If I'm doing a Belgian beer, I'll use a Belgian glass. And those things came out of culture, not so much we're nailing down this flavor or whatever. And I like that. I think to me that's more interesting.
How much hops is too much?
I don't think there is. There's always a balance, but I prefer West Coast IPAs. I just love IPAs. That's what I fell in love with as I started making my own beers.
I'll just go ahead and ask you the next question, which is, for you, what are the attributes of a good IPA?
Yeah, I tend to want a strong bitterness up front.
Yeah.
And then I want a lot of citrus on the back end. And I want to be able to smell that citrus. I want to be able to me, it should smell like a joint.
Yeah, like floral. absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I think a good IPA has that danky
kind
of aroma.
Yeah,
that danky.
Like you scrunch your face up a little bit.
Yeah.
If you were on a deserted island and you could take one type of beer with you, what type would you take?
That's easy for me. I would take traditional English bitter.
Okay.
And
pretty flat in terms of hoppiness, though?
So they call it an English bitter, but they're not really bitter at all compared to American beers. But English.
Why would you take that?
Just that's the beer I fell in love with. That's okay. When I first went to England, you go and you have an English bitter on the hand pull, and which we have a hand pull here now because of that.
I have a few questions about that.
Yeah,
we'll get
sure.
that in a second.
And I the beer was so smooth and just easy to drink. And it, over there, the beer is 2.5-3% too, so you can drink a lot. Yeah. And it's also not carbonated, so you don't get full. So you can sit there literally all day if you want and drink beer and talk to people and not get all crazy.
You're predicting my questions here, because I was going to ask you. I was just in London in April, last April. And I didn't know about their taxation system, where they tax based on alcohol percentage.
Oh.
So those beers that are like below 3% taxed at a lower rate, which makes them cheaper in some ways. What do you think about that? Do you think we should tax them?
I think that's ridiculous. I didn't even know that's how they tax their beer. Okay. I don't know any breweries over there personally to talk business about, so I didn't know how they tax their stuff.
What do you think about this hazy universe? It feels like it's the most oversaturated market in the beer space. It feels like a lot of us are starting to get hazy fatigue. Mm-hmm. Do you see that happening? And what's your prediction about like where hazies are going?
Yeah, my hazy is my second biggest seller.
Yeah.
And it's not slowing down. And after the Mexican Cerveza, we just sell a ton of it. And so I don't care what anybody says, I'm going to make it.
Yeah.
Because people
are
drinking.
So the market's saying it's going to continue.
I think what you get is you get a lot of people just trying different things. And to me, it's like on my menu, I'm not going to have even two hazies. I'm going to have one hazy because they're just not that different.
What's your juice ratio here? Because I get some hazies that are just almost like fruit juice.
That's what I shoot for. I like a hazy that almost tastes like a glass of orange juice.
Yeah, so you don't want a ton of bitter in it.
No, I don't like a bitter. In fact, we don't put any bittering hops in ours. We hop way late in the process, so it's
really?
All flavor. Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Do you think we need to expand, we're going to talk about food in a second, but expand more broadly this idea of pairings when it comes to beer? That's a really developed world in wine.
Yeah.
And where you can literally go to a Michelin star restaurant and they'll tell you which wine goes with what.
Sure.
Do you think we need that in the beer world, or is that something that's more niche for the wine world?
I think all that came from the wine world, and beer tried to copy it.
Yeah.
But I think there's a certain pretentiousness to it that I think is like disingenuous. You know what I mean?
I think
it resonates with people.
Beer's kind of a flat world, it feels like to me, where you could really pair a lot of things with a good beer. Yeah. So is it something about the beer that makes it like less? Like, you need to think about pairing with?
I don't know. I'd have to think on that, to be honest with you. I just don't think it's very much fun to tell people, okay, when you eat this, you have to drink this. You have to have these flavors
together. Because beer does have distinct
flavors. It does, yeah, of course.
Even more than wine,
right.
Really.
But if everybody that drinks wine, your normal person that drinks wine also doesn't worry too much about pairing. They're just like, I want a glass of wine with dinner.
Yeah.
And so I think you can just get carried away with this stuff and just make it annoying.
Yeah, so that's the snobby world. Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
At the end of the day, I want people to hang out and I just want them to drink beer and eat pizza, man. I really don't care.
Well, beer and pizza
pair
well. I think there is something about like bread and beer that kind of goes. But beyond that, maybe not too specific. When you're thinking about developing a list of beers, because you have six core beers right now, right? How do you think about inclusion in that list? And do you think about the totality of it? Or do you just like incrementally add a beer at a time with something you're excited about? Or are you thinking about like your, like a menu, if you will?
Yeah, I try to balance it out. Because I like to have a broad spectrum of beers.
What does balance mean?
So for instance, on one end, you have your light Cerveza, right? It's super light. It's easy to drink. It goes with everything, like you said.
Yeah.
And then on the other end, you've got your stouts, or you know, we have a smoked beer right now. That's a little, it's heavy and it's heavy tasting. It's a little different. And so those are. And then in the middle, you've got IPAs and other stuff, reds and things like that. So that's all. I just try to keep my menu balanced in that I have enough variety.
What do you think your most underrated beer on your menu is?
Yeah, that's hard to say. I would say the smoked porter. If you really want to try something different and really explore beer, the smoked porter is beautiful. But it's one of those things that people assume that it's going to taste like oil or something because it's dark. But it's actually very smooth and it's very light. It's very light-bodied, but it has a smoky aftertaste
that's just delicious.
What's
a person look like that comes in to order a porter? Is there like a common
attribute?
Is that more of a beer nerd beer in your mind? Or is it just something that people need to try, and once they try it, it'll become part of the rotation?
Usually when I talk to people and I'm like, hey, try this, and they'll trust me and they'll try it. And they're always surprised if I give them a dark beer and they're like, oh, I didn't think I liked dark beers. Because you didn't really sit and try a dark beer, right?
Yeah.
You just immediately assume that it has all this weight and heaviness. But dark beer, a good dark beer is not made like that.
Yeah. What should a good dark beer in terms of the body of the beer be? Really thick?
So you can get into milk stouts and things like that, stouts. But I like, so when you think about Guinness, right? Guinness has a very light body beer, but it's got that toastiness to it. It's got those kind of flavors. So
honestly,
it's still easy to drink.
Stouts are some of my favorites. I've said this on previous conversations with brewers. I love a good light white stout or light mm-hmm. stout, like an amber stout almost. Sure. Like Dragon's Milk is one of my favorite beers in the world from New Holland. And hey, I just love the kind of the light body, but that depth of flavor.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I think that stouts and beers like that, you get that in ways that you don't with other beers.
Sure.
If you were, let's say you offered a class, like how to taste beer, and you had a bunch of people that are regulars that want to enhance their beer drinking experience, mm-hmm. if you will, is there anything you would teach them about, like, either the back end of making beer or proper ways to taste or head, how much head you should have at the top? Or is there anything specific that would enhance their experience, you think?
There's rules about all that stuff, or so-called rules about that stuff. But I think beer, it should be an exploration. And so I don't like to nail it down that much. We talked about pairing earlier. I don't really like to nail it down that much. Have a beer and enjoy it. But I do think it's interesting to learn how you get certain flavors. You've talked to other brewers. 90% of every beer is exactly the same. And it's the last 10% that changes it drastically. Mm. And so that's always been interesting to me. Okay. And it's the same with like bread. If you make bread, if you make an Italian loaf or a sourdough loaf, it's the same bread except for maybe the yeast. So I think that's interesting part of beer making.
What are your thoughts on seltzers? Is that interesting to you? Or?
No, it's not interesting to me. I've never had a seltzer that I really enjoyed. Yeah. I really just sat and enjoyed drinking it. But I know it's popular. I know a lot of people like it. Yeah. But it's not my thing.
Yeah. From what I've heard from other brewers that have it on their menu is that it's really boring. You know, like making beer for them is fun. And seltzer just suck the fun out of it. Because at least Alex from Summer Fox said, you're trying to make the least flavorful thing possible and then adding the flavor at the end.
That's exactly
almost like Kool-Aid.
You're basically making sugar water and fermenting it and then adding fruit. So it's not very interesting to do. But I don't even like when I sit down at a bar and I'm drinking a beer.
Yeah.
I expect a certain experience there, and I don't get that when drinking seltzer. I feel like I'm drinking an alcoholic soda pop.
So you'll never have a seltzer on the menu?
No.
Okay.
No.
10 years from now?
I'm not saying, if the seltzer market got so huge that I just couldn't turn it down.
Yeah,
because I might have a business. So.
Yeah.
It does. But I would never make it. I would probably bring in somebody's seltzer.
Got it. So it does feel like people add seltzers to the menu to reach out to a certain demographic.
Yeah, there's always that in the industry. Yeah. There's a lot of buzz.
But that's why you have light beers, ultimately, if you're
in that
same
people
model.
Just don't like the taste of beer at all. They don't like the taste of the grain. And that's where we do a lot of ciders here. We don't make them, but we bring in ciders from two towns in Oregon.
Okay.
And we sell a lot of it. And because people just don't, they want to have the experience of sitting in the bar, but they don't like the taste of beer. So they'll drink cider.
Okay. Can you talk to us about your, is it a machine, British beer machine? Is that
it's called a beer engine.
It's a beer engine, okay.
And basically it's a hand pump. And the original beers in England, they didn't carbonate them. They didn't have CO2.
Okay.
So they didn't carbonate the beers. The only carbonation in the beer was what was left over from fermentation.
Gotcha.
And also in England, before they had refrigeration and everything, you kept your beer in the cellar where it's
colder.
Yeah, it's where it's colder. So how do you get the beer from down there up to the tap if you don't and you can't push it with CO2? Yeah. You got to pump it by hand.
Yeah.
And so that's what the hand pump is. It's a hand pump. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And so it sucks the beer out of the keg and deposits it into the glass.
That's fascinating. And is there a lot of maintenance with the engine like
that? No, it's super simple. It's a hand pump, so it's the simplest machine you can have, really.
Okay.
There's just a diaphragm in there. And
are you the only one in Fresno that has something like that?
Yeah, we're the only one in the entire valley that has,
really?
As far as I know. Yeah,
is it something that brewers would do because it's a cool thing, or is it more your affinity with like English beer culture?
Yeah, no one's ever done it around here. I went to a brewery on the coast, and they had a couple hand pumps. So that was cool, but most places don't do it. It's a pain because when you make beer for it, you can't carbonate the beer, so you have to make the beer almost flat, and then you have to keg it off almost flat and then store it that way. So it's a big departure in the beer making process from that perspective.
Is there taste differences in terms of when you're using the beer engine relative to if you just had it on tap?
No, it's a mouthfeel thing more than anything.
Oh, okay.
Because again, it's flat.
Yeah.
And what it does, when you pull that pump, it goes through there's a little shower head on the end of the thing.
Oh.
And it injects oxygen into the beer. And so that's what you get a nice, if you've ever had a nitro beer.
Yeah, I was about to say, is it similar to nitro?
It's very similar, In fact, nitro is developed to mimic the beer engine. Yeah, so what you get is a nice, smooth mouthfeel, and you get a beer that doesn't bloat you.
Okay. What's the best beer and Girl Scout cookie pairing in your mind?
I love the caramel ones they make.
Oh, the Samoas.
Caramel Delights, I think
caramel
they're
delights.
Called. Yeah, so we're doing cookie pairings right now. And so I pair the smoked porter with the caramel delight.
Oh,
and I think
okay.
it's
And what
I
are the, what because there's four of them you guys are
yeah,
doing,
don't
right?
ask me to recite them, though. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But
why Girl Scout cookies? It's that season, I know. But
yeah, no, we just had a mom reach out 1 year, and her daughter was selling cookies, and her daughter had to sell like 1,000.
Oh, man.
Like
she's
bit off way more than she
now.
Could chew. Yeah. And So I was like, yeah, come on in. I go, we love community things. Yeah. Come on in. You guys can sell. We're a restaurant, so it's okay to have kids and stuff in here. Yeah, come on in and sell your cookies. So they came last year, and she sold a ton of cookies. And so they're out here this year as well. So it's a lot of fun. And so we did a pairing just to drive interest in the cookies, and then hopefully then people would walk over here and buy boxes from the Girl Scouts.
That's great. All right, we just took a brief break, and I watched a pourer use the beer engine. And he had to pull it multiple times. What do you have to train people how to use the machine?
Yeah,
so what does that look like?
Yeah, so if you pull it too hard, you get too much foam. If you don't pull it hard enough, you know it's completely flat. So it takes about 4 pumps to fill a pint glass. We use 20-ounce pint glasses for that beer because I just wanted to, that's what they do in England, and I just wanted to be like that. But yeah, so you got to teach them it's all about feel, really.
So is that waiting for the foam to distill a little bit, or what are you waiting for? Because when he pulled the pump initially, it looked like the glass was full.
So the foam starts to settle.
Yeah, starts to settle.
Because again, you're injecting it with oxygen as you pull the pump, and so it'll really foam up, and then that foam settles into a nice fine foam, like if you had a nitro beer.
Yeah.
So that's what you're doing. So if you watch the glass, you'll see that foam cascade at the top, and it's really cool looking, I think.
All right, we're going to jump to my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you, and you just tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why.
Okay.
Are you game?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Leffe beer, the Belgian beer.
Oh, I don't even know if I've heard that.
Okay, skip that one.
Sculpin IPA. I've had a Sculpin. I liked it.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's overrated or underrated.
It became the staple for a long time.
Yeah.
And then Ballast Point got bought out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I haven't noticed a lot of innovation since then, but maybe I'm missing it.
Yeah, it's hard. It's one of those things. We're going to go through this list, but I'm not the guy who goes around testing all the new beers anymore.
You know what I mean?
But we'll give it a shot.
Okay, so this next one's pretty controversial. But I have asked my last 140 guests this question. I have to ask you this question. Are we ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Is Me and Ed's over or underrated in your mind?
I ate Me and Ed's for decades.
Okay. Give me your broad pizza thoughts on Me and Ed's. What do you experience when you... Because you live in the world of pizza. So what do you experience when you eat it?
Me and Ed's has I always thought was nice about Me and Ed's. They always had that kind of cracker crust, right?
Yeah,
with the cornmeal on the bottom.
Yeah.
And I always liked that. And I love a good thick combination pizza. So that's fantastic. Yeah, we make a completely different style pizza here. So you can't really...
apples and oranges. Yeah, okay. So if you go to Me and Ed's, what are you ordering?
I haven't been in a long time, but like I said, I don't go out to eat much, but I do. I'll order a combo. I'll get the one that has everything on it.
Yeah. Do you also believe, because my wife's from here, I'm a transplant, but she's convinced that there are better quality Me and Ed's and then lesser quality Me and Ed's.
No,
she's got a hierarchy map for the city of Fresno.
Yeah, no, they're franchised, right? So you never know, but I can say that they're, because I talked to distributors and stuff, so their dough, it all comes from the same place, like their flour mix is just for them. They should be consistent because it's not like each one's making it up, but they're all doing the exact same thing.
Okay. The next one, this is your music world, in-ear metronomes.
Yeah.
Would you use them?
Oh, I have, I played along with metronomes for years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Some people are like, they don't like it because they feel like it's diluting their immersion in the music almost.
Yes, I could get that. If you talk to Danny Carey from Tool, they don't even record with a metronome. They're just completely freeform because they like the music.
Does the quality, do you lose quality? Because I played in jazz band in high school, and the drummer, he would read that beats per minute.
Yeah.
And he would get the metronome synced, and then he'd sync it, and then he'd turn it off.
Sure. Yeah.
And then once he had the kind of sense of the speed, he would just proceed.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you have no metronome, how do you have quality control of your sound?
Yeah, I've done it both ways, right? I've played in live bands
and
where there's no metronome, you just go for it, and it's great.
Do you feel like you speed up over time?
You definitely do. You speed up and slow down, especially if you listen back. But in the heat of the moment, it's happened slowly, so people aren't jarred. But then on the other hand, I played worship music for a long time where you're synced with video and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So you have to be, because you can't, the video goes at one speed. And
it's true. Those slides.
You have no choice.
Growing up in church, I was the slide kid in the back. And so I'd push the arrow key. And sometimes when someone was, we had a guitar player that just wanted to, he was convinced we needed a guitar solo for every worship song. I wasn't convinced of that, but he
soloing
was.
Soloing for God. soloing for Jesus.
Yeah, but just switching those slides was always difficult. Next one. What's your favorite non-Fresno brewery? If you're at a store and you're looking in the beer section, which one do you latch onto that's not from Fresno?
You know what? I never really look for one thing. What I'll do is look for something that's maybe from a city I've never been to or one I haven't seen.
So explore.
And then I'll just give it a shot and we'll see what happens. And 9 times out of 10, it's fine.
Okay.
And it's fun to explore things that way.
Okay. Next one. The band Sum 41, over underrated.
Sum 41, I think, is probably underrated.
Yeah.
Talk about
it. It's making the comeback. Yeah. The kids are dressing in the 90s, getting the 90s music back, too.
Yeah, we opened, when I played for the band South of Shaw, we opened for their drummer when he had his Project Plus 44, I think it was called.
Okay.
So we opened for him, and we got to meet him and stuff. So that was cool. But there's a band that writes hooks like crazy, and so how can you not like a hooky rock song?
All right, next one, beer subscriptions. Some beer breweries try them. Do you think they're over or underrated?
I think they're overrated. Okay. I don't like stuff like
that. Do people sign up for those?
I don't know. I never have.
Do you guys have
a
beer?
We don't do a subscription, no.
Yeah, because in theory, it's nice to have, like, prediction of revenue, but I just don't know if people, because people, some nights they want a certain kind of six-pack, and other nights, and it's almost, you ever did those garden box, like, CSA, like, where you just get a whole box of eggplant, and you're like, what the hell? I don't want eggplant. That's not eggplant week.
We have, me and my wife are in a wine club, but we don't get to go out there that often, so most of the year we have no wine, and then we go pick it all up, and then we have more wine than we can possibly drink. So it's, I don't know how good the clubs are.
All right, matched grip or traditional grip?
I'm a matched grip guy.
Okay.
Only because I never did marching band. I never did jazz band in high school.
Do you think there's any value with that traditional grip?
I think there's value in a traditional grip. Yeah, because it just depending on the styles.
Yeah.
Did you see Neil Peart toward the end of his life? He actually got a teacher and he learned how to play traditional grip.
Yeah.
So he could do more jazz styles and better solos and stuff like
that. So it's more genre-based.
I think so, in a way.
Have you ever seen someone in your space use a traditional grip?
Like in a metal band?
Yeah.
I can't say that I have.
It'd be fun to look at it.
Yeah.
All right, next one. Cheese or mustard on your pretzel?
Cheese.
Cheese?
Yeah, okay. I like cheese. Yeah. We do both here, but I like cheese.
Okay. Dave Portnoy's pizza reviews.
I have. I didn't know he did pizza reviews.
He does pizza reviews, and he hates Neapolitan. I don't know why.
Huh.
He's a New York... Let me go ahead and ask you this next question. Tavern style or New York style? Because you do Neapolitan.
What is tavern style?
So tavern style is like the Chicago style, where it's like small, like cracker crust. They slice across it, so you get these kind of tiny pieces.
That doesn't sound great to me.
So you would lean more New York style?
Probably, in that particular case. Now, unless you're talking about Chicago deep dish, then I'm all in.
You like deep dish?
I love Chicago deep dish, man.
Maybe it's because you also love lasagna. It feels like lasagna to me.
That's kind of what it is. Like a lasagna
with
more bread.
Do you eat it with like your hand or with a fork and knife?
No, fork and knife.
Yeah. Growler or crowler?
Crowler.
Crowler.
Yeah, crowler all the way. I'd rather have a can. Than...
Growler's the glass.
Yeah, who wants to carry on a giant, like a... I always, whenever I have a growler, I always imagine there's three X's on the front. I'm in a washboard band or something. Just give me a can of beer.
I literally have a Summer Fox growler that sat in my pantry forever.
Because
I just don't even want to haul it around.
Yeah.
But I also know that growlers require a little bit more setup because you have to have a canning tool.
Yeah.
So maybe there's more upfront cost, but then you pay for it with the ease.
But it's way easier. It's way easier to fill a can and put a lid on it. We have a couple canners here.
Yeah.
Like the bar does them right at the bar. They fill your can and put it on and it zips the top on and it's fantastic.
Okay, let's say you're going to a barbecue, and there's just a liquor store right down the street from the park. All they have is mass market cheap beer. What are you choosing?
Probably Coors Banquet.
Coors Banquet? Yes, yeah. Gold Bellies all day.
Coors Banquet.
I don't know why it's so good. I guess for me, the hotter it gets, the more I lean to Coors Light. But those Gold Bellies are the best.
Yeah.
Do you think a double bass on your kick is over or underrated?
Oh, I think it's underrated because I've always played double bass.
Okay.
But in the later years, I used one bass with a double pedal because the sound's more consistent.
Okay.
And you don't have to haul around that huge piece of equipment.
It's very trendy. Like, people just like to just go as fast as possible on the double bass, which is cool. It feels, I don't know if you agree with this, it feels like it starts to cloud the music a little bit.
Yeah.
If you go intense with a double bass.
I mean, you
play
metal
or something.
A lot of times, you don't want just this ripping double bass lead over everything.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of things you can do with double bass. Like, you can throw in little triplets and little things like that really make it tasty.
Yeah.
That's how I use it mostly. So.
West Coast or Belgian IPA?
Ooh, I like West Coast. I like a solid West Coast IPA.
Okay. Why?
I like the bitterness. I really do.
So you're a bitter guy.
I am a bitter guy. I like,
Next one. Non-alcoholic beers. Are those over or underrated?
I've tried them all. Right.
Okay.
So in brewing industry, you won't talk to a brewer who hasn't had to take a break.
Yeah.
So what do? You turn to non-alcoholic beer.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of great options, but I would say the best non-alcoholic beers are the ones that are based off of the biggest commercial beers.
Mm.
So like the Heineken and the Corona. Like,
what
those
do you think
are
of
pretty
Athletic
solid.
Brew? Have you tried those?
Yeah, we've carried like Athletic here.
I have mixed feelings because... And I talked to Alex about this, again, to go back to my Alex conversation. He's convinced they're just tea.
And I'll tell you what, because they have this odd sweetness. They have this kind of...
It's hard to get that bitterness.
Yeah, it tastes like unfermented wort to me, a lot of them. And the body's always lighter because you don't have the alcohol in there. And so it's just... I don't know, man. I'm not. If you want to have a beer and you're really cutting back, then they're a great option. It's really, yeah. They're lifesavers in a lot of respect. But I'll never try to make one, probably, because
it feels like you're trying to. Some of those, I know, my wife is always looking for those like healthier versions of X, and that kind of feels like right. what it is, where you get like something that resembles this other thing.
Yeah.
But your actual pleasure experience is pretty low. Right. And then you're just like, why didn't we just order a salad? Why are we trying to simulate something?
That's the thing. It's like ordering a burger that's made out of vegetables. Why don't you just order salad instead of trying to make your vegetables look like a salad?
Absolutely. All right. Let's talk about pizza.
Yeah.
What is for you in your mind, the ratio between sauce and cheese?
We have a weighed out. I could pull the numbers for you if you want.
But
my sauce... I like a sauce that's lighter, like less. Because you want a taste of it, but you don't want your pizza swimming in liquid.
Because
it
does get soggy on
It will
the
get soggy.
Undercarriage.
And Neapolitan is a thin crust pizza anyway. The body of the pizza is very thin. So you really can't have a lot. Can't have too many greens. Can't have too much sauce.
Okay. How do you avoid grease on cheese? I know that's a common complaint of people where they'll see like a pool of grease swimming on it.
Yeah.
How do you avoid? Is that the quality of the cheese?
Yeah, just get better cheese.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the more grease, the worse quality.
And it depends.
Cheese.
And it's the same with pepperoni too. There's pepperonis that you want that are made to hold that grease, right? Because some people like it. But it always comes down to quality. Yeah.
What's the best cheese for a pizza in your mind? Like mozzarella?
It's definitely mozzarella. There's other kind of cheese. Like we have a goat cheese pizza, but it just has a sprinkling of goat cheese.
Right.
We do a pickle pizza, has a sprinkling of cheddar. So there's other, your base is always going to be mozzarella if you're going to do.
Do you have one person just shredding that cheese all day, or you get pre-shred?
We buy it pre-shredded because anything I got to cut.
Well, how do you melt
out.
It? I know they cover it with like potato starch and different things.
No,
like...
not this stuff. So
okay,
if you buy quality cheese, like our cheese only, you can't leave it in the fridge. It's only going to last 4 days and then it's done. So we order cheese twice a week. And so all our cheese is super fresh, but it does come pre-shredded, so we don't have to do that work.
Okay. I've eaten a lot of your pizzas.
Yeah.
And I will say, when I'm bringing friends from out of town, we do come here quite a bit. And we have this ongoing debate with this friend that comes regularly about how long we should wait before we grab your pizza off the pan.
Mm-hmm.
You want it to set a little bit?
Yeah, you do.
So how long should I wait?
Yeah, I'd wait a good 5 minutes probably, because when you get it, it's 700 degrees.
Yeah.
So it's going to burn you, and then and then it might not even, it needs to gel up, the cheese needs to reform a little
bit.
But
it's hard though, right?
Give it a little bit.
Because you're making Neapolitan pizza, which is naturally floppy.
Yeah, that's the style,
But that's the style, so the setting is just about temperature really, or is it about the actual stability of the pizza slice?
I think it's a little of both, because it is hot. If you grab a fresh out of the oven, you're putting 700 degree cheese on your tongue, you're going to feel it.
Yes.
So give it a little time, but also set up. But we always say embrace the fold. Take a piece, fold it in half, and eat it that way. And it's a lot more manageable. But the Italians will eat it with a knife and fork, but trying
to
get any Americans to do that
is... I've been to Naples. I've done that experience, and I'm just going to say this. It's probably controversial. I like American pizza better.
Do you?
I do. And I think I had some good pizza experiences, no doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt. But there, I think we're so obsessed as a culture, whereas pizza, it feels, is just amongst a web of Italian food that is incredible.
Yeah.
But I feel like we have nominated as one of our gods. Pizza is one of our gods. Why does a pickle pizza work?
It's just one of those odd things, right?
Yeah.
So when how it came about was we were going to do some kind of like pickle, like fried pickle appetizer or something like that. But then once we built the place out, we didn't have room for fryers and stuff. But we still wanted that. I still wanted that kind of pickle thing once in a while. And so I started playing with it, and I tried different cheeses and different types of pickles, and that's what we settled on. So it's based on an appetizer. If you had fried pickle spears, that's what we based it on. But that's kind of what it tastes like. It's bready and it's sour and
because you need something that bites through the richness of the cheese.
Yeah.
So it feels like you could sub in, not everyone likes anchovy pizza, but that's I think why it works.
Yeah.
It's just the richness of it.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what you were thinking in your head? Something to cut through?
Yeah, it was mainly because I wanted to do, again, I really wanted to do breaded pickle spear, fried pickle spears. But that was the closest thing I could get with the equipment we had.
Do you prefer white or red sauce on your pizza?
That depends. It really depends on what else is on the pizza.
Okay.
But my favorite pizza is just a straight-up margarita pizza, so I guess I would have to say red sauce.
Okay. Let's say you go to a pizza convention. You're sitting at a table talking about Fresno, and someone says, Dana, describe the pizza scene in Fresno to me. What does it look like there? How would you describe it to me?
I wish I knew. I only know the pizza scene here in my bar.
You know what I mean?
Because what does most people do? Before I got in the business, I'm ordering from Mount Mike's or Eater's Order Delivery from whatever.
Would you call what you do artisan pizza? That's what you would call it, right?
Yeah.
And so these other pizzas, you would just they're just, I don't know, mass market.
Like. I think it's fine, right?
Yeah,
I mean, unless you're using frozen dough, then I have a problem with you. But if you're still making your own stuff and it's your style, that's fine.
What's your hydration in your dough?
We do a 65% hydration.
Okay. Can you explain hydration for people? Because this is really important for pizza.
Yeah, it's just
not really understood.
It's just like bread people will know this too. It's the amount of water in the mix. So you start with flour, and your flour is 100%. And then your water is a percentage of that. And so when we say 65%, that's adding 65% of the volume of the flour.
So more hydration equals what?
You just get wetter dough, obviously, and it arises different and things like that. So 65 we found is a good...
So that was through testing and iteration?
Yeah, exactly. We tried 70, 75, but it's hard to deal with.
Yeah.
65
you're
makes
sticking
it,
your fingers,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, 65 makes it easy to deal with. And we got to teach just anybody to make a pizza. And so it needs to be... You're not going to get... artisan pizza makers in Fresno. It's not like a million people that are, you got to train anybody to make a pizza. So that's what we settled on. But we also do a 24-hour rise on ours. So we make it the day before. If you've ever been in here, it doesn't happen very often, but if you've ever been in here.
What's the difference with that extra rise time?
The flavor of the yeast is able to just generate a lot more flavors, and you get a better gas in the dough and stuff. But any bread maker will tell you that the longer you rise your dough, the more flavors you're going to get out of it. Mm. And
what do you think about sourdough pizza? Have you tried? I know this is like a kind of a niche thing. And
yeah.
It feels like a lot more work, and I'm not sure like the actual payoff
right.
on that.
Yeah, I've never tried it, honestly.
Yeah.
I make bread at home, but I don't even make sourdough bread at home because I don't have a week to mess with starters and stuff.
What is your kind of salt level that you're looking for in your pizza, like in the dough itself?
I've always said about salt that if you can taste it, it's too much.
Okay.
Salt's a flavor enhancer, so it should enhance the flavors that are already there. If you're tasting salt, you put too much in.
Okay. And then you told
me
this.
But it's normally, like, if you want a percentage, I think it's something like 2% or something like that. I'd have to look.
And you told me this before, but if you could explain it again, temperature-wise, are you trying to cook the pizzas as fast as possible, the highest temperature possible, or you want them to sit there for a while?
You want that. So our pizza's cooking about 2.5 minutes.
Okay.
So what you want is that really hot deck in the oven, and that causes the dough to puff up, like, really fast. All the moisture in the dough turns to steam, and it puffs that dough up. And that's what gives you that nice, chewy crust on the around the edge.
Do you think people sleep on crust? Like, you'll see trays after people leave or whatever, and you'll have those kind of, like, semicircle crust thing. Are they just messing up? Are they missing out?
Yeah, I think so. That's what makes a Neapolitan pizza, to me, is that band of crust around the outside.
What's the best Neapolitan you've ever had?
I don't know. I can't remember any particular restaurant or anything. But like I say, I do love a nice, clean margarita pizza because... Whole basil leaves? Yeah. I like whole basil leaves on mine. Okay. But the way I look at anything, beer included, is I like things that have few ingredients. I want 3 or 4 ingredients so you can pick it out, so you can taste those flavors without everything just becoming a jumble.
Yeah. Let's talk about some business and kind of brewery scene stuff.
Yeah.
What do you think the benefit, some brewers operate in isolation where they're not talking to people. What's the benefit of reaching out to your colleagues that are working in the same space?
Yeah, it's just the more information you're pulling from people, and a lot of it's just those friendships, right? I love when all the brewers get together. We try to do these mixers once in a while where we all get together and have a beer and we talk shop. There's just inherent value in that.
What do you guys talk about?
Just all kinds of stuff. You name it. It's all the stuff we've talked about today. It's all the same stuff.
A lot of us would want to be flies on the wall for that. I'm just curious.
It's not that interesting, honestly.
Yeah.
But, you know,
just nerdy conversations.
Yeah, a lot
about
of it. Depends on who it is, right? If you talk to one brewer, I'm not going to name any names, but you talk to one brewer and it's all about the science of brewing. Yeah. Talk to another brewer and it's all about how they're making money. Yeah. So it varies depending on who you're talking to. But as being in the industry, it is about understanding what we're doing. It's very helpful because those opinions and those viewpoints matter. You know?
It seems to me that Fresno is a very generous brewery culture.
Having
talked to a number of brewers now, it feels like there's a sense of we're in this together kind of thing, and it doesn't seem like it's a zero-sum game where I'm in competition with you.
Can you
talk about that? Because I think that makes Fresno unique.
It's really cool. I think the brewery industry is like that, period. Yeah. I'll get a call once in a while from another brewery, and they'll be like, hey, I got shorted 2 bags of grain. Can you loan me some? And we'll drive over a bag of grain. And I've done that too. I've called someone and said, oh man, I thought I had yeast, but I don't have any. Can I borrow a brick? And so we all support each other. We all do that. And then when we get together, we all talk about, hey, what are you guys doing? How you handling this issue? Or how you bringing in people on a Wednesday night? Like all those kind of things. We share that information. Because again, they're all good people, right? They're all good guys. Everyone's just trying to make a living like everyone else. And so the more you help each other out, I think that it builds the whole thing up.
How would you, if we're talking about the brewery scene in Fresno, in terms of like stages of development? I know we're not in infancy, but where are we at? I had one person say we're in a juvenile stage, another one said a young adult, which I'm like, that's the same thing. But where
that's
you,
a good analogy right there.
How would you describe where we're at?
I would say we're in our teenage years. We're still trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
But the industry's changing too. So like I say, Fresno's way behind in as far as just generally having a lot of breweries around. You had one brewery for the longest time, and even they got started late. I mean, when we talk about Tioga and stuff.
Yeah, and you probably heard the news about Sequoia.
Yeah, I did.
Shutting.
Yeah, that's terrible.
What was your response to that? What did you think when you heard that?
Heartbreaking, really. And two thoughts came to mind immediately. One, that sucks, because they're a staple. You know what I mean? They're just a standard, Fresno standard. Everybody knows Butterfield, so you should if you're into beer.
Yeah.
And then, but the second part was like, how could they possibly let that happen? That business has been thriving for decades.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
It seemed like somebody. I would go to the Tower location, and I'd also go to the North Fresno, and they always seemed like they were moving.
Yeah, they're always ripping.
Without trying to speculate as to why they were insolvent, do you think it was probably food or beer? What would you speculate?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's probably, and I don't have any insider information. I don't know the owners. But to me, the first thought has got to be some kind of mismanagement.
Yeah.
Because how's the business that's that entrenched?
Do you anticipate someone might want to buy that?
I would hope so.
I would hope they keep it going. Yeah.
You know?
I think they need to innovate a little bit.
Yeah,
Restaurant that knew their, brewer/restaurant that knew their identity, so they stuck to their lane.
Yeah.
And so I wonder.
But in a lot of ways, that works. You know what I mean? It's worked for them for a long time.
Yeah,
you know
absolutely.
I mean?
But going back to that, the state of Fresno beer, why would you say we're in the teenager specifically?
It just seems like to me that other cities our size and bigger just have a lot more breweries. When I go to visit family in Oregon, they're like 7-Elevens. There's a brewery on every corner, and they're all really good, and they all do a lot of different stuff.
Could Fresno support that quantity, though?
I don't know. See, that's why I don't know.
That's the trick, right?
That's the trick. You've got to get people to come in. I still think we're underserved. Yeah. I really do. When you look at how many breweries are in Fresno, what is it, a handful? Is 7 or 8, 9 maybe?
Yeah.
I still think there's room.
Let's talk about downtown a little bit. You guys are in a different location than what they call the brewery district.
Yeah.
How do you think about your relationship to the brewery district?
Yeah.
Are you an extension of that, an annex to that? Like,
I don't really consider it at all.
Okay, right? so that's not a factor in your head.
No, not really. And it wasn't when we opened either.
Okay.
We weren't. In fact, in the back of my mind, what we were looking for was the right building. And I didn't really care where it was. If you find the right building with a neighborhood around it, you probably do well.
Yeah.
But so part of me was like, do I want to go open right there with everyone else and compete against 7 other bars and breweries?
So you were there, you would look at it as competition a little bit.
You have to.
Because that was always my question, because we're talking about we're underserved, but also it can sometimes be hard to get people to downtown.
Yeah.
And if we have 4 breweries on a block in downtown Fresno, is that too much?
Yeah, it's one of those things. What are you really gaining? I think the reason they like going to different breweries is because they like going to different neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So why do you want to go one place? It's like going to a mall, like a beer mall.
Yeah.
So I've always enjoyed different atmospheres. But again, we were looking for a certain type of building with a certain type of neighborhood. And when we found this place, immediately we looked around and we started seeing that all the apartments around here and the fact there's nothing else on this side of town, on this side of downtown. So it just felt immediately, this is the place where we can be the neighborhood pub.
This is a restaurant.
Yeah.
But it feels, I've lived in San Francisco, Los Angeles, I've lived in big cities. This feels like a neighborhood restaurant to me. It's kind of vibe, I guess.
Yeah.
Like where you'd have just this, and I think big cities can support this, where you have like high quality food, but it feels really local to your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Why doesn't Fresno have more things like this?
I don't know. I think a lot of it is because the way the city has grown. We have a lot of strip malls, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing nice about going to a strip mall,
right?
When you think about it, at least to me.
So it's an urban planning problem.
I think it is. We've got a lot of sprawl, and you've got just one strip mall after another. What's different about one strip mall than the other, right?
Yeah.
But when you're downtown here, every corner there's a new building, a different building with a different character. And so I've always been drawn to downtown for that reason.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. That, and like I say, it's just the things to look at are interesting.
Yeah. What was this building like when you showed up?
It was just like this, except it was just empty. There was just a big white cube.
Okay. What did you add to the building? What did you bring to it that you wanted to make it yours?
Yeah, you can see how it's done. We've got an L-shaped bar with the cold room right in the middle. You can see there's a lot of trim. We really went for the English pub vibe. We have that leather right behind you, custom made. So that's what we just wanted to make it feel warm. But still have it open. That's why we love the windows.
Oh, that's the best part.
The natural light.
The windows, really. Because sometimes you go into a brewery and you feel like you're locked in like a solitary confinement cell.
Yeah, it's dark.
It's dark and moody.
Too industrial looking.
Maybe if you and I are getting a beer at a pub in England, we're into that vibe. But this is California. This is sun.
Exactly.
Like, you don't want to see the outside.
Yeah.
In London, you don't want to see the outside because it's gray every day.
Exactly.
So Talk to me about the name, South of Shaw. I know it's connected to a band you're in.
Yeah.
But it also has, that's not why people, when I talk to people about South of Shaw, they connect to a different meaning.
Sure.
So is it multiple meanings? Is it like...
No, that's what it is. Yeah. We can go back and talk about it a little bit. If you watch the news 20 years ago, probably still today, you'll hear them say South of Shaw 10, 15 times per newscast, always to talk about a murder or a car wreck or something like that.
Yeah, South of Shaw and Belmont.
Yeah, so exactly. So South of Shaw has always took that kind of thing, it was the connotation between Old Fresno, New Fresno, or Good Fresno, Bad Fresno. That's what it became.
Yeah.
And so what happened was the guys I was playing with, they had decided to do their punk band. And what do you do in your punk band? You adopt something.
Yeah, you flip off authority.
Yeah, and you make it yours. And so they adopted South of Shaw as the name of the band.
Yeah.
So eventually I joined the band, and we had a great run. We played a lot of good shows and stuff, had a lot of fun. Yeah. But during that time, I was homebrewing too. Yeah. And so what happened was when I left the band, I just decided to call my garage brewery South of Shaw just because I thought it was cool. And then, as my friends got interested and we decided to actually make a business out of it, they're like, well, what are we going to call this? Because South of Shaw doesn't sound like a great name for a brewery to me. And they're like, no, that's perfect. Let's just run with it.
Well,
and
make a pitch. So let's say there's a brewery coming to town. Yeah. Maybe they have another location somewhere in the valley. And they look at Sprawl and they go, I'm going to start this off Fryant.
Yeah.
So there's maybe a building off Fryant and there's a building downtown.
Yeah.
Why should they go downtown?
Like I said before, downtown is where all the character is. And we like to say all the fun happens south of Shaw.
Yeah.
So
It's true. Yeah. Absolutely true. Let's talk about a few more things. There's been a lot of drama about Art Hop.
Yeah.
And what is your general thoughts on the city getting involved? And what did Art Hop bring to you guys?
Yeah. So I've been to some of the Art Hop meetings because we do art every month here. We do Art Hop. We're a member of the arts. Arts Council, I think they call it. But so what was happening is you had a lot of people coming in and it wasn't art related. They were just looking for a party. But those things are good. I always say more people on the streets in your neighborhood is better. When you're talking about business, more bodies is better.
Yeah.
But there was a segment of the artist community that didn't appreciate that it was becoming a party and not an art thing.
Yeah.
For us, I'm like, hey, more bodies is better.
Abundance.
And so
right?
I don't care. Like, I don't care why they're coming as long as they end up here at the end. And it was working out really good. And then, but like I say, people have pull, I guess. And so they shut it down.
Does it hurt you since Art Hop's gone away?
That on the Art Hop night, it's probably 30% down from what it was. But that's just one night. It's not
because
a big, we're still doing it. And so.
I know there are some breweries that have said that they essentially paid rent for the month based on the Art Hop nights, just how crazy and wild it was.
Yeah.
But it seems like you guys have a steadier traffic where it wasn't as much of a dip.
Again, we're a restaurant. And so if we were a pure play brewery, I could see it being different. But we're a restaurant, and so that kind of levels out our expenses and stuff.
What's your hope for downtown? What do you think we need more of? What's your vision for where you'd like to see downtown go?
I would just
as someone that's a stakeholder.
I would just, honestly, I would like to see some of these old buildings, something done with them. We've got a bunch of probably investors that don't live here just hanging on to property because they can, but they don't plan on doing anything with it. They're waiting for some imaginary payday.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, you've got plywood on the windows and it's not doing anything for the neighborhood. So I've heard of some cities who have laws that say if you don't develop a property, then you forfeit it. Maybe something like that. I don't know how hard that is to make happen, but I think at some point you got to look and say these.
So what would you hope those, let's say that there's a penalty, so then you got a bunch of property owners going, what should we do with all this space? What's your vision for when things could go downtown? More places like yourself?
I think that's it.
More
I think,
shopping, more retail?
Yeah, all of it. I think housing is huge. And when they started putting in a lot of housing in here, I think that's really helped. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What percentage of people that just wander do you think live around here?
Oh, it's a lot of our customers. Yeah. We have a ton of people just walking in. And and they like it because, again, we're their neighborhood pub. So they walk over, have a couple pints, walk home. Everybody's safe. It's a lot of locals.
So to conclude podcasts, I always ask my guests how what they do affects the way they see a place. So my background is I work in education. So I tend to see the world through the lens both in problems and solutions. I just assume there's a problem out there. If we educate people and give them the right tools, then they might make a better choice that will help their lives. So that's my lens at which I see the world. How does running a neighborhood restaurant, neighborhood brewery, pub, whatever you want to call it, how does that affect the way Fresno?
That's a deep question. It's hard to just fire off an answer.
Take time to think about it. Because I think we all have a unique vantage point in how we look at a city. And I've been compiling now through the show a bunch of different vantage points. And I think it really helps us to clarify what we see when we look at a city.
Yeah. For me, I've said it how many times during this conversation is I want to bring people together. You know what I mean? Because I think there's something just inherently interesting about meeting someone new and hearing about their lives and what's going on. And so I think if anything, everything we should be doing as a community should be focused on bringing people together. You know?
And then that ties into your no TV model, right?
Yeah, like exactly.
Talking to each other. When I look, we're sitting in the middle right now and there's no TVs going. We see multiple tables where people just talking, chatting, interacting with each other. And I'm looking around right now, I don't see a lot of people on their phones either.
No.
Which is incredible.
No.
And I think that's one of my favorite things about what you've done is you've created a space where people just want to come to hang out and interact with each other.
Exactly. And we'll hear that all the time. People are like, oh, I was down at the pub and I met this person and now we're best friends or whatever. And now our kids know each other and all that stuff. So it really is just bringing people together. And
For you, Fresno becomes more situated in the people by doing what you do, and you can see how, like, having hubs for people can really accelerate interactions and connections. Kind of summarizing what you're saying?
I think so, yeah. We live in a kind of a society where it's like, what can you buy, right? You go to this place and you buy these boxes, and you go to this place and you buy those boxes.
Yeah.
But where do you go to just really bring the community together? Like, we don't have a lot of the arts and stuff anymore. We don't have a lot of these things where people used to gather, especially in Fresno, you know what I mean? If you're in New York, you got theater and you got things like brings people together for that shared experience.
True. It's
but
so
in Fresno,
true.
It's you can't even have a decent concert here. Like, you get two concerts at the St. Mark Center a year.
Yeah.
So, I think, so that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to bring people together, and
I think you're accomplishing it, and when I'm wanting to just, it's a Friday, and I'm like, I don't know where to go, I come here.
I appreciate it.
I come here, and I think that a lot of people that visit from out of town, which is interesting, because all of friends come from big cities, and I'll bring them here, and they almost describe not having something quite like that. And so I think it is a unique institution for Fresno, and I hope we get more of these.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have you hinted at another location. Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of where that could be?
No, don't have a sense of where that could be yet. Again, for us, it's got to be the right building and the right neighborhood.
What are the attributes? If you're like, if you talk to a real estate broker and you're describing where you'd want to be, and let's say it's not in downtown, where would you look?
Yeah, that's hard to say. Again, I would try to find some place that has a really dense neighborhood that is underserved by other businesses, you know what I mean? And then that's where you can, and then if you have a nice building on top of it, that's where you can become that neighborhood icon.
No pressure, but we just talked about a business and tower going out of business off of Sequoia. It looks like it has a facility that could match your needs.
I don't know that my pocketbook would handle that purchase. But
tower does feel like it could use more of that energy. Which I think would be great. But let's close with book recommendations. This is my favorite part of the podcast.
Yeah.
As a librarian, I'm paid to talk about books all day. What are some books you'd like to recommend to listeners?
Yeah, so there's two that I would recommend, and they're both brewing related, obviously. But there's one called Brewing Classic Styles. It's by a guy named Jamil. I'm gonna butcher his last name, Bezina Chef, I think.
Okay.
And this guy has won medals in every single brewing category.
Yeah.
So he's made every beer, and he's won a medal in every beer. And so this book is full of his recipes. And he gives you the full recipe and how to brew it. And I think
would that be a good one for
excellent
like
for
a home
anyone who wants to homebrew? Yeah.
That's, if you were on that note, because we're talking about it, what advice would you give to a homebrewer that's starting out? Just like a motivational advice. Like, obviously, just, do your reading, do your research.
Yeah, have fun with it, though.
Yeah.
Have fun with it, because you can get really tied up in the science and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's supposed to be fun. And you just want to make something your friends can get together and drink with you.
Yeah.
So just have fun with it.
Yeah.
Don't take it too
seriously.
Is
there a beer you'd recommend to start with that's like a no-brainer?
Well, I started with that English bitter.
So that's all
I can say for me.
Pale ales seem like they're easily transferable.
Exactly. Any simple beer like that doesn't have a crazy hop schedule or stuff. That's what I would start with. Yeah. So
okay. What was your other book?
So the second book is, and it's called The Affordable Brewery by a guy named Tom Hennessy. When we started our place, we went out to Colorado and spent some time with a guy named Tom Hennessy.
Okay.
And this is his, I had read his book, and then we went and consulted with him. But he talks about how to build a brewery on the cheap. And so he was real famous in brewery circles for a while because he would do talks about how you can build a brewery for $25,000.
It's funny, when in my conversation with Alex, and people will hear this, I asked him, what he would do if he started a brewery, or because he, anyway, that's neither here nor there. I asked him what he'd do if he was starting a brewery from scratch, what would he do differently? And he said, have more money, right. Which I feel like is intuitive, but
that's
like,
it. Yeah.
But I think he was saying that it's really hard to start an operation with where you're undercapitalized and
yeah.
you don't have
yeah.
that. And yeah. so this guy taps into that.
He taps into that. So he's a restaurateur. He had Italian restaurants, award-winning restaurants.
Yeah.
And then when the brewing thing broke, he decided to squeeze a brewery into his pizzeria.
Ah.
But he didn't have any space and he didn't have much money. So he figured out how to do it on the cheap. And he would use dairy tanks and wine tanks, whatever he could pick up. Because a
yeah.
tank is a tank. You just need stainless steel.
Yeah.
So he learned how to cram breweries into very small places and make them. And then he started opening actual breweries. So
yeah.
at the height of his career before he retired, I think he had 7 breweries.
Wow.
And they're all small breweries, kind of like ours. So our yeah. model is built basically on his model.
Yeah. So kind of be scrappy when you start out.
Be scrappy, man.
Yeah. Because at the end of the day, you'll forget how hard it was once you get to that scale.
Yeah. yeah.
And so you got to cut those corners while
yeah.
you can.
Exactly. And again, if you're opening a brewery, buy the things that matter, right? So you don't need a bunch of fancy equipment with fancy logos on it and all this stuff. You can make beer a lot of different ways. And so focus on the things that are important.
That's fantastic. All right. To close, what's going on south of Shaw? We mentioned the Girl Scout cookies. How long are those available?
They'll probably be. So we're doing the pairing anytime, but we're promoting it mainly when they come in to sell cookies.
Okay.
So they'll be selling cookies, I think, every Saturday for the next month, I think.
Okay.
We have to check with them, but we'll post it on our Instagram when they come out.
Okay.
So that's fun. We do vinyl swap meet the third Thursday of the month. That's always a lot of fun with hundreds of vinyl records out here. That's a kick. Karaoke every other Saturday.
I saw on Instagram you're developing a new beer, or there's a new beer in the works right now.
We always have a new beer in
yeah,
the works.
Yeah, so what's the new beer in the works
when
right
it's
now?
It's new, it doesn't always mean it's new.
Yeah,
it just
yeah.
means we're making it new.
Yeah.
But yeah, right now we have our Summerland Pilsner. It's
okay.
a straight up German Pilsner. It's going to be going in tomorrow to the tank. It'll be on tap tomorrow.
I don't
Wednesday.
Know if you feel this way. German beers are so underrated.
I love German beers.
Like a good culture,
yeah.
good Pilsner.
Yeah.
Like,
I love German beers.
Because it's one note, but it's a perfect note.
Yeah. yeah.
I just love
it. It really is good. And so that's going in. And then this weekend we brewed our Belgian Blonde. So that'll be out in a couple weeks.
What's the flavor profile of a Belgian blonde? I don't know if I've had one before.
Yeah, it's nice. It's you can compare them to a Saison probably or something, but the yeast that we use is a Belgian yeast and it imparts kind of a little bit of banana, a little bit of coriander kind of flavors into the beer. So it's really nice. It's a nice, easy drinking beer. And we don't make it too alcoholic either. You can have a couple.
Yes, absolutely. And if you have a couple, you can have a pizza, and then that's
yeah,
the
absolutely.
Ultimate sponge. So, Dana, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for taking the time to
Thank
talk with
you.
Me.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.